Hello, everyone. This is the Debor Taiwo Talk Show, also available on all podcast platforms as Conversations with Debor. And of course, today we have an amazing personality today. On the show, I am so honored and excited to have a chat with someone who has defined resilience and someone who has been able to inspire a lot of millions of people around the world on redefining their faith. I'm talking about the one and only Keiichi Okuchi, a plane crash survivor, but more importantly, a finalist on American Got Talent, a motivational speaker, and an author of a book. Right? Maybe she's got more to write about. You're welcome to the Debor Taiwo Talk Show, Keiichi.
Thank you so much for having me. We've been planning to do this for a while, so I'm happy that we finally can.
I know,
So,
right? I know. It's always things like this would definitely happen at the best of times. Yeah. So, but I'm really glad and I'm really excited to have you on the platform.
thank you.
Yeah, you're
Happy
welcome.
to be here.
Yeah. Happy New Year to you as I'm seeing you on this face value
Yeah, it is
for
first
in
time.
2025. Yeah.
Yeah.
All righty. So we'll just get into it real quick. I wanted to find out about you. On a personal note, before the events of December 10, 2005, you
Okay.
definitely had aspirations. You had your dreams. So while you were growing up, can you just share with us what life was for you, particularly as you lived in Aba before you moved to Port Harcourt? How was child like for you growing up?
My childhood was very happy, very joyful. I had a lot of just fun and freedom as a child. My parents were very loving and very present. And I was an only child for 10 years before my little sister was born. So I had all their attention. And I was very particularly close to my mom. So, I was, people used to call me Harappa because she's just like, she's carrying me everywhere with her. And we used to go everywhere together. I loved spending time with her as a kid. And yeah, I would say that my parents fostered a very, warm environment for me. And very familial too. It was very focused on family relationships. So I was very close to my cousins as well. So and on both sides. So I really enjoyed that. So despite being an only child, I never was really alone. But being alone for most of my childhood, when I'm at least at home with my parents, did help me develop some like certain, I guess, hobbies that are considered more solo. So things like playing video games before, the era of, playing online started, and reading books, playing Barbie by myself, and watching lots of movies and just a lot of things that are solo activities. I really nurtured those things as a child, and I really enjoyed that too. Also writing was a big thing for me, but more in high school. But I had a really, really fun time as a child, I would say. So when I look back on those memories, it's usually with happiness and with pleasure because it brings a smile to my face. So I'm grateful to my parents for that.
Of course, I mean, your parents did definitely do a very great job nurturing you, and I think your sister's name is Tara, right?
Yes, she's Tara. Yeah.
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 So they did a very great job nurturing you guys, and we'll definitely deep dive into all of that in a couple of minutes from now. Of course, we just talked about how your upbringing was, but after the events of December 10, 2005, and for those who will be watching this, I want to assume everybody who's seen this, I've heard about this story before. There was a plane crash, and Katie was involved in the plane crash, and she was one out of the two survivors from the plane crash. How did
Yes.
the upbringing that you had, how did it shape, or what role did your family members play in getting you out of that dark moment that you experienced at the time?
I think very significant, extremely significant. I mean, the fact that I had that bond with my family and including my extended family, it played a very significant role in how I was able to heal, not just physically, but also emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, especially. I think The closeness that I had with my mom, most specifically, was what had the biggest impact, because that closeness is the reason why I'm here today. Her presence from the beginning up until this moment I'm here speaking to you has been like it was pivotal at the time when things were at their worst, but overall has been the biggest contributor to the person I am today. I think presence at that very pivotal time is what has allowed me to become a fully independent and whole person from the inside out because of the kind of care that she gave me and attention that she gave me at the time when I needed that the most. So there's a lot to be said for, of course, like the medical part of things. Without the doctors and the hospital care and the surgeries, I would not be here. But without my mother's care and her love and attention and my family's care and support, I would be a different catchy. So I would be alive for sure, but I don't know who that person might have been. So I attribute all of the way that I am right now to the fact that the people that I cared about were there for me at my most difficult moment. The accident happened when I was a teenager, which is arguably the most I want to say most conflicting time for human beings, as teenagers were very, we're in the middle of, not quite children, but not quite adults. And that moment of time is like the most crucial for growth, especially emotional growth, mental growth. So I think it's a testament to the kind of people that were around me that I was able to navigate being a teenager that was also a burn survivor, really. So yeah, I would say, long story short, they played a very significant role in bringing me out of a very dark place as wholly as possible.
That's really evident from the from this book. Again, for people who don't understand,
My
she's an author. She wrote
book. Oh,
books
thank
Scarred at My
you.
Scars. So if you haven't seen this, if you haven't if you've not heard about this, you probably want to read this. This is a very inspirational book. You would
Thank you
change,
so
it
much.
was change. You would have at least one or two lessons to pick from this book.
Wow.
I have, picked a lot of lessons from it as well. It was
Thank
really interesting. It was emotional reading the book, but it was a great inspiration as well. All
you.
right. For sure, you definitely described your mother as
Yeah.
well. All of this, like you just said right now, you described that even in more details, in very glowing words, in this book.
Yeah,
And
very
something
good.
that fascinated me when I was reading the book, I think at the point when you started, when you were now able to regain your voice,
Yes.
started talking, you did tell your mom about an incident that happened in secondary school back then. About you being entangled with a guy, like you shared your first kiss moments with your
Yes, I did tell her that. I told her
mother.
everything.
And then you even went a step further that she shouldn't bother about the other part because
Yeah.
it just shows how much closeness that you had with your mom
Yeah. I
at the time. And obviously, she's
think
still
I
there.
definitely I surprised her a lot during that time, I think, with the
When I read that part, I laughed. I'm like, oh
things
my
I
God, this
said.
has been a very, bonding moment for you and mom.
Yeah, it was.
But again, recovery process from the events that you narrated in this book was definitely challenging, How did you find the courage to revamp yourself? I mean, you were 16 when this happened. Some other people, they might have just, it might have taken them down completely. Like your self-esteem, that's what I'm particular about. Like, how are you able to rejig your self-esteem and turn out to be who you are today?
This one is a little bit of a tough question for me usually, because I don't want to make it seem like I'm like it was it ha there's two parts to it. So first part is the way that I was made, the way I am, just my normal disposition as a human being at the time. I think as a 16-year-old at that time, I was pretty grounded in some things that I think matter. And I had a good sense of self, a good sense of my worth as a human being, my value as a person that went beyond what society might say of me and my value. I will say that that part of me was nurtured by my parents.
Mm-hmm.
They were my first line of confidence boosters from childhood. So by the time I was a teenager, you really couldn't tell me anything that my parents hadn't already told me. They were the ones that were the most like encouraging and motivating and in, like they didn't they, of course they care about grades like any other Nigerian parent would, but they always made sure to let me know that they didn't think that my value was based on how well I did in school. They made me feel like I had value, that my value is a result of many different factors, some of which I may not have found at that time yet, you know, as a 16-year-old. So I think I would say my parents first. They definitely boosted my self-confidence in a way that I think influenced how I was able to react to this thing that had changed me so drastically. So they solidified certain things about who I thought I was at that age before something so horrible happened, and would make me face a very judgmental world that might try to tell me how to feel about myself. So I would say my parents had a role in that first. Second thing was definitely my faith. I think it's important to note that, you know, at the time the accident happened, while I was a Christian, I was not necessarily a person that would be able to say I had a close relationship with God, a personal relationship with God. That was something that developed over time from maybe months after I became a patient in the first hospital. And I think that my growing knowledge and closeness to him at that time helped me understand that my physical appearance had to take a back seat. And it was okay for it to take a back seat because there were more important things like my health and my just living. But then also to understand that like I don't have to define myself by standards that I no longer adhere to, like I don't adhere to the normal standards of beauty anymore, and I never will just because of what has happened to me. And I had to understand that that's okay because value of a human being is measured way beyond their physical. And I think I say that it's God because the way that God was taught to me, he was a being that didn't care about the physical. You know, he was a being that expressed throughout his word that, you know, the intrinsic things are what matter. You know, he likes qualities and virtues over how you look physically. And I was being taught that this was the person, the being that created us and made us who we are and loves us infinitely. So it just made sense to me at the time to tie my self-worth to this non-human, because human beings, you know, even your parents, even your family, people are judgmental and are not consistent, you know. But one thing about God and what we know about him is that he is ever the same. And so if he loves you, he loves you. There's never going to be like the love is never going to be qualified. The love is the love that he has. And so that means that if he feels like physical is less important than intrinsic stuff, then that's going to be his that how he feels about human beings that he created for eternity. So I could trust in that belief, in that point of view that he had of us, his creation, more than I could trust human beings. And I feel like that combined with the way that my parents had raised me to be confident kind of created this fusion situation where you couldn't tell me anything, basically. You know, I felt like once I could see beyond my physical being important, then the whole world opened up to me because now I didn't have to bother conforming. I didn't have to worry about doing anything physically that I don't want to do. It will never be based on what people want me to do. It would always be based on what I want to do, how far I want to take things. And then I had a support system that validated that feeling inside me. So I had people around. It's one thing to believe that, but then when you have people around you that are always telling you like whatever you want to do, we're behind. It makes you feel even more encouraged that you're doing things the right way, that you're the way that you decided to live your life, it's a good way. It's a rational and sensible way, and it works, you know. So I think that that was it really. I had so much encouragement to just think the way that I thought. And approaching life in that way is also easier too, because You don't have to worry about other people's feelings and well, not feelings, other people's
Opinion.
perspective, like
Oh,
opinions, of
perspective.
you, of your physical, when you're living your life. So that way I could still have fun and still crack jokes and have my sense of humor and be myself. I didn't have to change just because the accident changed me physically, because I didn't change on the inside. And so I have to just trust that when I meet people, I can show, they can give me a chance to show them who I really am beyond my physical appearance. And so that's pretty much how I've just lived my life. And I have to say, so far, the results have been pretty good. 99.9% of the time, my experiences with human beings have been very positive, or at least just neutral. But I can count how many negative experiences I've had based on my physical appearance, on one hand. And I'm grateful for that, because it's been more than 16 years since the accident. So, that's a lot of time for a lot of bad things to happen. So, but they happened. So I think I'm on the right path. I think it's okay.
1,000%. I mean, your parents did lay a very solid foundation in how to, overlook what the world would judge someone's as it concerns appearance. And I think
Yes.
you did a very fantastic job that it, okay, so to your point, you didn't have to switch your attitude. So
Exactly.
after the accident, I think you had a few friends come visit you and now
Yeah, I
stop
know what you're talking
if
about.
you were at the hospital or if you were back home in Nigeria. And then you made it, you went past the mirror and then you made a snide remark
Yes, I know. About myself.
about how you look. And then this person was like, this kitchen has not even changed. Why am I even feeling good? That was really, I mean, that just kind of summarizes exactly what you're trying to say. But it's I wish a lot of people would be able to have this kind of mindset on how to feel about themselves. That way there won't be so much pressure to how would I put it now? There'll be so much pressure to make people feel in a type of way just because you want to get acceptance socially.
Like to conform, to
Yeah,
like
exactly.
to what people feel, should be, versus what you really want to be or how you really want to look.
It's a really, really good perspective to have, and I hope that this changes a lot of stuff for some people who will be
I
watching
hope
this.
so too. I hope
Yeah,
so.
in the book, again, Kechi is an author, if you guys don't know already, Murder My Scars, very inspirational book. You did mention that your mom was definitely the rock pillar. She was the reason in fact, I think at some point you stated it explicitly, like apart from God, she was the reason why you're alive. Survived that tragic incident of that time. But you then narrated in your book that you had a dream that you saw like an Harry Potter character.
Yes, yeah, that was so weird, yeah.
Yeah. So the point I'm trying to go is, so obviously you already said that before now,
Yes.
your Christianity, it wasn't as rock solid, but
Yeah.
God was telling you to rely on yourself, to
Yes.
pray more. How do you think that event shaped your spirituality after that specific dream?
That was very, it was a very weird. It was a very weird dream. Also, because of the character in the dream, I didn't even, after like the first time it happened, like when it happened, initially I didn't really know how to take it, and I didn't know how seriously to consider it, because, what a way to like, give me a much needed message, but I was taught that, sometimes when things happen, like you sometimes you sit up and you just kind of like observe. And this was one of those times, especially because of what was going on in my life at the time and how I was feeling physically and mentally. So it was a message, and it was like a wake up call. It was like someone was telling me, like, you need to like get your act together. Like, you need to get your act together, or like you're gonna spiral. And I needed a way to, like, something that would let me listen to this message, because at that time I was definitely struggling with even giving God any time because of how badly the effects of the accidents were affecting me at the time. The more I healed, the worse my feelings became, because the more I healed, the more alive I was, the more I understood how, like, the gravity of what had happened to me. The more alive I was, the more aware I was of just how injured I was. The more alive I was, and more aware I was, the more I realized this is not going to be oh yeah, once you're done in the hospital, you go back to your regular life. Regular life was moving further and further away the more aware I was of how bad this was. And so my mind, my mentality was getting very desperate and frustrated and scared because I was now feeling like, how long am I going to be in this situation? Oh my God, like high school, what about like the plans I had for after like high school? What about my friends? What about like just anything normal? You know, like how, when will I have actually be able to be doing anything normal? You know, I couldn't at that time. There was no way to envision a moment like this right now happening. It was so much, it wasn't even an imagining. I couldn't even dream of this kind of moment. And you know, in those days, my mom would just tell me, Kechi, you will look back one day, believe you me. Like, I know that it sounds like something people just say, but one day this will be a memory and you will smile and you will shake your head and you will be like, wow, I can't believe how far I've come. That I just need to trust her that that is what is going to happen. And I just didn't understand how she could say that while looking at my situation, because I would be like, how? I could not envision that. So I think I was very resistant at that time to any message about God, especially because I'd also just learned about, like, you know, how bad the accident had been and how many lives it had taken. So I was in this like turmoil internally, you know, learn about this God that was supposed to be so good but allowed 60 kids to die. And my parents were doing everything they could, my family, my grandma, to just pray for me, to talk to me about God, to teach me about God. My mom was working so hard. Like, I made it tough for her. She would go back to her family. She would say, see what Ketchy is saying. I don't know what to say. And then they would pour into her, and then she would come back and pour into me. Of course, I realized this after the facts, but like that was what was happening. And I remember after I had that dream, I knew something had to change, and it was a moment of realization and a moment of also kind of like frustration, because I realized I was standing in my own way of how things could get better. So I was feeling stuck, and it was my fault, essentially. That's how I felt at first. I felt like God was saying, you're feeling this way because you're not doing what you're supposed to do. So it put responsibility on my head for the first time since the accident happened, you know. But so far it'd been like, you know, nothing, this all happened to you, Ketchy, you know. But now I was being told to take responsibility for something. And it was of my praying life, my prayer life, my relationship with God. He was telling me that it was something I had to start nurturing myself. My mom had done a lot, but there's only so much another person can do. There's a lot of internal work that has to happen, and that cannot be done by anybody but the actual individual. So I was being urged to start taking some responsibility in my own healing and in my own life and in how things are going to go moving forward. Because now for sure I was not going to die. But now what was coming into the picture was determining what kind of quality of life I was going to allow myself to have and if God was going to be a part of it. So yeah, it was definitely a wake-up call to start just trying to talk to God on my own and not relying on just my parents' prayers, my mom's prayers, my aunt, my grandma, my dad. I had to like start actually like talking to him directly and not be so angry at him, because I was angry, you know, because I just kept on feeling like, if you're so great, you've already proven you can save lives. You saved my life. You saved that other lady's life. Why wouldn't you save other people's lives? It doesn't make sense to me, because you clearly can. So that was like my major struggle. But I had to like understand that my anger would be there consistently if I don't talk to him and try to figure this out, you know? So I think that was like that dream led to me starting to take my prayer life a little more seriously. And, starting to take res some responsibility for how my life was going to be moving forward. You know, that was like my wake up call, I think. So, yeah, it was a very interesting time, especially and very peculiar, you know, to have that wake up moment with Harry Potter. Like, it was just like, okay. But I think, you know, God will use whatever he thinks will make you listen and make you look and make you focus and notice. And of course, that was like a major interest me at the time, still is. So yeah, that's what that was.
I'm glad that the dream was able to inspire you or encourage you to see things from a different perspective. And of course, strengthening your relationship with God, which who is the supreme being and who's majorly responsible for why most of us are alive today,
Exactly.
despite whatever that we might have done in the past. So, but we give God glory that things have actually turned out better than you were saying prior, that you even imagined at the time. We would
Thank you.
switch it up a little bit, but before we switch it up, I wanted to find out. So obviously, you were. I would say a lot of people, had this support for you. Like there was, prayer support. A lot of people were looking forward to the delivery, especially as you narrated in this book again. Kechi is an author more than my scars. It's year. So talking about relationships now. So I have this question. It's a double barrel question.
Okay.
So first off, you did have in Nigeria, you had fundraising support from
Yes.
people like Yemi Somachi and the MD of Shell, and a lot of people's friend, came around to support you
Yeah.
and the family as you had surgeries in South Africa. That definitely is a testament of how much of a good person you must have been, especially to your friends who, raised the fundraising part. That's my interpretation of what happened in the first leg. However, when you got to the States, I think it was maybe during your bachelor's program, you did focus essentially only on bachelor's program, and then at this time you neglected relationships
Yes,
in a
I did.
sort of way that you felt that impacted you in getting jobs.
Yes.
How would you describe, having to be in that fix? So at one point,
Yeah.
relationships, helped you, and at the other point, you felt like, oh, you were lacking in
That's
relationships.
a very interesting question, actually. I've never heard that's really nice. Interesting. I think with the first one, it was the relationships I had with these people that made them feel like they wanted to do something good for me.
One
And
hundred.
so help me for sure. But I think, yeah, it definitely it's what the I guess the contrast in those two situations would be that these were people that I knew prior to the accidents. Have to foster anything new. Those were that situation, that fundraiser that raised money for like my continued like surgeries and everything, that fundraiser was done by people who were people that I loved and cared about prior to the accident happening. So after the accident happened, I didn't really have to do anything special or new to foster or create a relationship with them. It already existed. These were people that I already loved and already loved me. And by virtue of that already existing love, they did this good thing for me. The fundraiser that happened after I became graduating, bachelor's degree holder. And that fundraiser was for my was went towards my master's program. And that was a fundraiser that happened because while I was in my undergrad, I didn't do any internships and I didn't make any efforts to do anything besides focus on my studies. And I say that it's different from the last fundraiser situation because I struggled with forming and creating new bonds post-accident. I didn't, and it was definitely something, and that I realized while writing the book that while I was writing and analyzing different things, I realized that that was definitely some kind of traumatic response from the accident. I didn't want to know any new people because of what had happened to a lot of the people that I already knew that had passed. I felt that I was good with whatever I already had. So the effort to make new relationships, to form new bonds, felt unnecessary because you just never know what would happen to people. And the more people you care about, then the more you have to lose. That's just the facts, Of course, it doesn't mean that we should withdraw and not form relationships, which is what I was doing at the time. But it's definitely the reason why. So I think it was very interesting because during the like having to face the fact that like this happened because I refused to like have any kind of bond with anyone, it was definitely an eye-opening situation, but not one that I realized at the time. This is something that like you saying it now has like made me realize because at the time I just thought, I just didn't make, good choices as an undergrad student. But then the reason I didn't make that particular kind of choice was because I didn't want to know anyone, anything like deeper than surface level relation. I mean, of course, I had friends, but they were mainly classmates, you know, they were acquaintances, nothing really developed past school. And so I think that, yeah, that's definitely something that had I been a little more open to being to forming bonds, new bonds with people post accident, I probably would have, you know, had my head more out of my books, looking around and formed like, you know, networks that could have helped me, you know, and not had me having to resort to, you know, raising money so quickly for my MBA program. I would have had a chance to work first, build up money, and then do an MBA program like most people do, like maybe like after 5 years of working, you know? So, but I'm really grateful that despite that, you know, there were people that rallied to actually make that MBA happen for me because, you know, that MBA ended up really changing my life. Not only because during that program, something significant happened. I mean, during like the MBA program, another program happened in that situation. But then graduating with that program, I was much more of a people person, you know, by the time I graduated. And so I formed relationships that did lead me to, you know, landing like a corporate job. So like it's this is a very good point that you brought up. I've never actually made that connection before.
That connection, yeah. It was just more like there was a little bit of a twist there. Like, okay,
Yeah,
I need
very
to
interesting.
put it like that so that you know I get it to you. Okay, so in about 3 minutes, so that I can put up another. This is gonna last in about 5 minutes. So maybe in 3 minutes, I was gonna ask you one question, and then we'll do like a second round, and then ask you the rest of the questions. You rejected signing up for disability services when you m migrated to the state.
Yeah.
What was your reason behind the decision, and how has it shaped your outlook on independence? Just in about 3 minutes.
Honestly, that was a decision I made because I had to look at myself honestly and see if this would be, if me accepting this service would be me being complacent. I knew after being a patient in Shriners with after moving to America that there were people that were burned like me, but in much worse conditions. And I got a lot of perspective becoming a patient here because I realized that out of all these burn survivors, even though mine looks pretty bad physically, it's all surface. I maintain all my limbs. I have all my hands, my legs, my I had the ability to, with surgery, help of surgery, do many most things myself. So I didn't feel it would be right for me to take use a service that I didn't really qualify for, even though I look like I might, because that's why offered to me. But the reality of it all was that I was able-bodied and I couldn't lie to myself that I was able-bodied. And you know, at that time I was very much into not doing anything that would make God upset or you know make him feel like I don't want to do anything that would make me feel guilty down the line, you know, because I knew I see people every day with wheelchairs and with other disabilities that are like legitimate. And I felt like just because I look like it like I have a disability. And of course that makes me want to advocate for people with disabilities as well, because I will use that opportunity to do that. Doesn't mean that I have to benefit from those services and take that away from people who actually need it. Because I felt like, you know, I mean, I'm walking everywhere, I'm doing everything. Eventually they're going to realize I'm not disabled. So I didn't want to like, you know, take on something that I would have to explain later, basically. So yeah, that was really my reason behind this.
That's a really impressive reason, because a lot of people wouldn't have thought about it this way that you're saying it. Most people would have, maybe other people might have felt like, oh, let me take this opportunity, let's make some money out of this and stuff like that. So I thought that was really remarkable. It shows the kind of I'm running out of words now, but just the kind of moral value that you
I
have,
see
you hope.
that I have. Thank you.
It's
I
really
tried.
all right, that sounds good. So I think I would pause this and we'll log in and then ask you the next set of questions. Is
Right,
that
no
it?
problem.
Thank you.
Yeah,
So
no problem.
I
All right,
just
sure.
right. So this is the concluding part session of my interview with the very amiable, very loving someone who has a very like an angelic voice, right? Or someone who has an angelic voice, actually, an inspiration to millions of people. Kechi Okuchi, concluding session. Kechi, thank you again for making time out for the show.
Yeah.
I We really appreciate your presence yesterday. So, I wanted to find out, very probably last question around the December 10, 2005 incident, which would be 20 years this year, by be 20 years this December.
Yes, 2 decades.
Yeah,
Jesus.
it'll be 20 years. Time flies. Yeah, you talked about, obviously, I mean, for most of us who were in Nigeria at the time, we knew that the very sad incident, there were two survivors, and that would be Kechi Okuchi, who I'm interviewing today, and someone else called Bunmi Amusan. In your book, you described the way like fate played in such a way that you had the physical trauma as it concerns the incident, because you had to be in the hospital, you had to go through a lot of surgeries to get better, and you were not even aware of what had happened or the gravity of what had happened until many months in South Africa. However, you described the relationship, or the situation rather, with Bumi Amusan as more of psychological, in the sense that she probably did not sustain so many injuries, but she could relive the moment of what happened. But again, the question would be, what's the relationship been like after the incident, after that incident?
Every time Bumi and I meet in person or even speak over the phone, it's always very emotional because of this very unique situation that we share. It's just something about, there's something different. There's just something about that connection. It's just indescribable, just being the two people that survived such a thing. Something, there was always going to be a relationship with between the two of us at some point. And it's always so emotional because every time she sees me, she's reminded of that day, and I say that way because when I see her, it's more of a, I'm relieved because I can see that she's okay and I'm happy to meet up with her every time I meet her, but I don't necessarily have my mind being pulled back to the events of that day specifically because I don't quite remember the details about that day, and that's obviously played a big role in how I've been able to heal from that day. So, not remembering those key moments has helped me not just in how I'm able to process my situation, it helped me really focus on my healing and not have to worry about having nightmares about. I mean, I did have recurring nightmares, but they were never about like the impact. I think that that would have made things much worse. But so not only mentally, but also in just my living my life without restrictions, being able to still fly despite having been on a plane that crashed, I owe all that to the fact that I don't remember the most horrible part of that accident, which would have been the impact. But Bumi remembers everything. So when she sees me, she's transported back to that day because in her mind, it's still very fresh. And she, every time I see her, the last time I saw her in person was in 2019. Last time I talked to her was sometime end of last year. Whenever we talk, it's always, very sweet, very loving, very, we pray, and I'm just happy to hear her voice because I'm happy to hear that she's doing well, But I also know that, like, Bumi has lived a very restricted and very reserved life since the accident because she didn't want anything to do with anything that had happened. She wanted to just be left alone, to go back to her quiet life and not deal with press, not have to deal with anything that would remind her of
I
that day.
believe.
That's all she's wanted, And she's never done any interviews or any, you wouldn't find anything like that because she doesn't want anything to do with it. But when I came to Nigeria in 2019, I had a chance to meet her, and I wanted her to come, but of course, always I'll extend my invitation, but I would never expect her to come because I know she doesn't like to really leave her house or leave her area. But she came to an event that I was singing at in Nigeria when went home, and she came on stage with me, and she, for the first time, that was how she told me that that was the first time that she was talking about anything to do with that day with anyone outside of
Outside
me.
of family. Oh my God.
Family. That's her family. Yes, you're right. That's her family as well. That was the first time. And that she was only going to, she was only doing it because I had come and I had asked her to come. And it's not something that she's happy to relive ever. You know? So it's definitely very obvious that she there's very long lasting psychological I guess turmoil from that day that has remained with her up until at the very least 2019, you know? And of course every day I pray that she's better, but I know that she's never flown since then. She's never gotten on a plane since then, and I don't know that she ever will. So, you know, it's a shame, you know. But at the same time, you know, whatever she feels comfortable with, I mean, she of all people, she should be allowed to make whatever choice she wants to make, right? So, yeah, so that's why I said it in that way in the book, because it was very clear that she had not retained any burns, but had retained a lot of the memories. Yeah, the memories have not left her, and they've like kept her a little bit in the past, and it makes me very sad. It makes me sad, you know. But at the same time, I'm also happy because she's alive and she's here, you know. And there's somebody I can say that, you know, has this shared experience with me. But at the same time, I also know that, like, I, given the choice, I mean, it's rock and I mean, neither choice is good, but I don't know that I would ever trade the, I guess, the fallout of the accident that we've got. Because, you know, yes, you know, not getting burned is great, but at the cost of a lot, in my opinion, you know. So if having these scars and these burns and these injuries is my lifelong sacrifice, I guess, to make sure that I can still have a like a life that is not restricted, you know, like, you know, one place, and you know, I'm able to do the things I want to do despite having, you know, never looking like normal, quote unquote, again, then, you know, so be it. Because, you know, I wouldn't trade the things that have happened since the accident for anything. I've had a lot of amazing experiences. I met a lot of amazing people, and that would never have happened if I had never wanted to get on a plane again, you know? So yeah, it's a lot of like it's a lot of conflicting emotions really when it comes to me. But one thing for sure is the love and support. It's always been there constant since the first time I came back to Nigeria after the accident, which is about 7 months after from Africa. When I came in, she came immediately to see me and my family. And, you know, so she, yeah, she's a friend of the family, you know, obviously. And yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, like, to be honest, it's definitely a very tricky one. You did describe everything you just said, you described in the book. But again, for you specifically, I'm glad that, again, to your point, you didn't remember the incident. I think that's the reason why it was easy for you to hop on the plane. But again, even when you, so my question would be, your very first experience that you had to go on a plane, that you were not, like you were not in an air ambulance or anything, like that you had to, that you were,
Aware.
were you scared in any way, or were you jittery? I know you did ex you did mention about a plane incident from, I can't remember what state in the
It was in
U.S.
2019, yes.
Exactly. I know you experienced that in detail, but that's not what I'm asking. I'm just
That's
asking,
about
the
the
very
first.
first time you got on a plane again that you were aware of, did you feel any atom of scare, fear?
No, honestly, no, because the worst had already, the worst thing had already happened. The thing that everyone fears the most when getting on the plane had happened. Like, what else? Like, really, what else? And honestly, like, aside from that, it was the fact that I was kind of resigned to the fact that, like, it seems this is unavoidable. Getting on the plane doesn't seem, look, despite the fact that I got on a contr this thing and it crashed, somehow it still seems to be an unavoidable part of living life. Somehow, the day after the accident happened, I had to be flown on a plane to South Africa.
Interesting.
Seven
Sure.
months after it happened, I had to
Come
fly
back.
home from South Africa to Nigeria. I came to Lagos first, and then the day after I got to Lagos, I had to fly on a plane from Lagos to Port Harcourt, and I had to fly from Port Harcourt to Abuja on like in February 20, 2006, to board a plane from Abuja to America, for which is where I've lived since 2006. So like I feel like I'm sorry, 2007. So I feel like really like when you think about it, by the time I got on the plane that was taking me from Abuja to America, I had already been conscious on flights at least four times. So it was just like apparently we can't do anything about it. I'm just gonna keep getting put on planes. So at this point, like, and it's for my own good. They're all trying to get me to destinations where people will help me. So it's just like for fun and games. Like, so it just seems like very counterproductive to be afraid of this thing that like seems to be a necessity for me to be better, which is ironic because it's the very thing that caused my situation in the first place. But again, I'll always come back to the fact that like I don't remember the impact. I have to keep on coming back to that because that it makes a very big difference in like how a person processes things. Of course, I remember when the plane was in the middle of like falling from the sky. But again, what I remember from that is mainly screaming and like everybody screaming, but we weren't like rolling around in the plane when it was, we're still like all strapped into our seats, you know? So it was just like that feeling of like, you know, that weird feeling of like floating, like almost like a roller coaster when it was like falling to the ground. But not remember the impact, I think, is the main reason why I can still live my life this way. I cannot imagine, remember, just even thinking about it is like a scary thing to think about, much less experience. So I don't fault Bumi for feeling the way she does about it. And especially considering what happened in 2019, that tried to take that away, like this, to, like the fact that I could fly away from, you know, you realize that like fears can be developed at any time. You know, so after having the plane, being on it, I mean, the irony is not lost on me that a plane crash was not what made me afraid, but a plane being shaking in the air is what made me afraid. But at the end of the day, like that's how the mind is, you know. And who knows? I do feel like, you know, the thing in 2019 shook up some things also from the past that I you know, I never had had like, you know, happen before. Like, you know, no one had ever, nothing had ever happened that had like kind of challenged that experience before head on. So, you know, I had a lot of things I had to deal with that. Luckily, I would say as of now, I'm still better. I'm still a little like fidgety when like, you know, the plane is like shaking because that, you know, the kind of thing.
But
Yeah.
that option.
Yeah. But I just feel like it's really at this point now, if you take away the plane crash, what I'm dealing with now is what I think most other people deal with when flying. And if you've had one bad flight experience, you know, just kind of like you get on, I just like hoping, I hope everything's okay. Like, you know, like I think like everyone that's had like at least one bad flight experience feels a little bit of like
Of
weight.
course.
Yeah. So I don't have anything beyond that, which is like the normal amount. And I'm
Which
grateful.
is
Thank
yeah,
God.
that's
I won't
absolutely.
do anything. Like, I won't go anywhere now, you know? So.
Interesting. Really interesting stuff, KJ. Again, thank you for sharing all of this with me. So I would switch it up 100%, promise, after this one. You have obviously you have a great platform. I don't know if you have a podcast of your own. I definitely encourage you to have one if you don't yet. But I'm gonna
I
ask
have
you this
told that.
question. Sorry?
I have been told that several
You
times
thought like,
actually.
yeah, you should, because you definitely have a platform. You have a platform and you've experienced, I mean, what not a lot of people have experienced. I feel a lot of people would feel very safe to share some of their darkest moments with you. But the question I have is around your addiction. No, it wasn't addiction, but a little bit of addiction that you had to Domicom and morphine at the time. So my question would be around the fact that how can you use your, how would you be able to use your platform to be able to influence people to dissuade from addictive stuff like drugs and all of that stuff?
I think I would use my experience to dissuade them in the fact that like with addiction, you think you're in control, but you're not. And I feel like it's even more emphasized in my case because I didn't even have access to my medication without doctor approval. I was administering my medication to me. It was a routine thing that the hospital I was in was controlling. I didn't have the ability to just do it whenever I wanted. And even then, even when it was being given to me routine, like as a routine, even when it was something that I needed because of my pain and my all the different things I had going on with my accident, like even in that controlled environment, addiction still happened. To me, that shows just how powerful these things are, these substances. They are not to be taken for, they are not to be tr like, they're not to be underestimated, essentially, because it can even happen when the hospital is the one giving it to you and you have no way of giving it to yourself. So just what makes you think that when you have access to it, free access, and you can use it whenever you want, you'll be able to like handle it and you'll be able to avoid addiction? You won't. It will ruin your life and it will change your brain chemistry. The thing about it is definitely it changes the way you think. In my situation, my moment of clarity came when I realized that I wanted this thing even as it was actively harming me. I didn't, because that moment of dopamine rush, that moment of high that everyone is when they're getting that drug, that moment, even though it was like maybe 3 minutes, maybe at most, was to me worth the hours and hours of itching and reaction that my body will have, negative reaction that will have after taking this thing. That's how much it changes the way you think. You stop thinking rationally, because that's not a rational way to think. Why would you keep on actively craving something that is harming you as you're taking it? That's not a normal way of thinking. But when you're in the middle of it, it makes complete sense to you. And this was me again, I will emphasize, when they had it on a clockwork routine system where the doctors and nurses were the ones administering this. It was not whenever Ketchy wanted, it was when the doctor said I could have it. And still I craved it like I've never craved anything in my life.
Anything like
So when after they weaned me off of it and I finally started thinking normally,
that?
scared the crap out, I realized how scary that was. It really dissuaded me from ever like coming in contact with anything like that with like in the world with like with my independence, because clearly I'm not to be trusted with it. And so why would I even like do that to myself when I know what it can do to me, even when someone else is the one in charge of giving it to me? So I feel like it became something that I became actively afraid of, mainly because of the way it changed my thinking. I didn't like the fact that I wasn't thinking rationally. And to me, that's something that has always been a thing for me. I'm very careful with alcohol. I do drink, but like I'm very careful to do it. Like I'm careful about the company in which I do it. I'm also careful about the amount, because I don't ever want to get to a place where people are telling me what I did and I don't remember. To I that's one of the things. I hate that feeling. I don't like that feeling. I and it's not about control. I think it's just about like awareness. Like I don't like I don't like having moments of batches of time that I don't have any memory of. I have an active it's something that really is a dissonance that I don't like about it. And I do think it might have to do with the fact that I did lose a lot of like swaths of time during the crux of the recovery period of the accident. So I don't want to be in that place
Not in
again.
that space anymore. Yeah,
Yeah.
sounds good. Sounds really good, to be honest. I had to laugh at that point because,
Yeah.
anyways, this interview is a lot.
Are you remembering? No, you're
How
remembering
you
some
know
things
me?
by yourself.
So
You
I
were
won't
just
say anything about that,
moving.
but it that it made
You could
it
relate, huh?
it touched me. It did touch me. All right, so let's switch it up. I know a lot of people will be so interested in knowing how you got to America's Got Talent. Again, Kechi has a book. She's already explained everything there. I already know how you got in there. But I wanted to find out first, before we talk about America's Got Talent, how did you discover your passion for singing, and how has it helped you, or how did it help you cope, and then snowball into how you got into America's Got Talent?
So the singing thing since childhood, really, I've always loved it. I grew up in a family of m music lovers, including singers, instrument players, things like that. So music is something I've always enjoyed as a child. I was in a children's choir in church. I was in choir in school, in high school. I used to sing for like club events and stuff. I used to sing in like school plays. So singing is something that's always kind of brought me joy, just growing up in general. And then in my teenage years, my voice was good, but definitely not what
Do it.
thank you. It
Do
developed into something more later on for sure.
it.
I attribute that again to the accident, because my voice did change after the accident. No, but I don't really, it's something that I can't explain, but something that like my mom and I like noticed immediately the first time I sang after, we're like, that's like you, I mean, you sounded good before, but this is something's going on. And I think like at the time we didn't really question what was going on, you know, because, you know, usually with play, like burn victims, the there's usually some kind of smoke involved. And typically what would happen when it comes to voice or vocals is smoke inhalation would affect the lungs in a negative way. So for something different, so different to have happened to me was like a blessing in this really dark time that we just kind of took happily. And I was just happy to have something fun that I could enjoy in this time when I could barely move. It was nice to have music. And my mom, you know, she knew how much I love music, so she made it a part of, like, she, from before I opened my eyes from my coma, she literally was playing music by my bedside. She called my cousins and my sister, asked them my favorite music and albums, and she bought it, and she would play, and I would hear the music playing like in the coma. And I woke up, I knew songs I didn't know before the accident, which was so interesting, you know, to realize that in a coma you can, the patient can hear things. But then, yeah, with the voice thing change, the voice change and all that, I sang, obviously music became like a part of my joy and my escape. It became a thing that I could enjoy and that I could, that could heal parts of me that like no surgery could really heal or reach. And it was very cathartic too. It was a release. It was fun. And then when I got to America, Shriners made it part of my therapy. So I had music therapy as well. And I think I had my first concert in Shriners concert, but it was like, you know, for the little kids there. And I just kind of got a little taste of what it felt like to, like, you know, be on the stage. And it was nice, you know, it was fun. And eventually, it took me a while, but eventually I joined my church choir like as an adult. And I'm still in it, you know, and I love it so much because it fills me and allows me to enjoy something that, you know, God gave me, and I can, you know, give it back to him, you know, and that's
In that sense.
so just to, like, you know, it's just like music was just this thing that brought me joy and was this wonderful thing I could share with people and with my loved ones. I would never have considered sharing it on a stage like AGT, but God had other plans, obviously, and I'm very grateful for how things have gone so far with that experience, you know. So yeah, music was a big thing for me growing up, and it just, I think when you think about it, like, it was only kind of natural that it would end up in this kind of situation, you know, where I'm using it for this. So
100%. So again, you narrated specifically how you got on American Got Talent, but I
yeah.
want people to hear from you. How did you get on America's Got Talent? What inspired you to go on, on an audition, and then you were on America's Got Talent, and then you actually even stayed true to the very end of America's Got Talent? What inspired you to do that?
I was not inspired at all to do that until I got on the show, because I was never going to apply for that show or any other show for that matter, because while I love singing, I did not think that my voice was something that any judge would be like, oh yeah, that's so good that she needs to like be on this show. Like, I didn't think I had a competitive singing voice, but I had people in my life that believed I did, specifically my mom. I mean, my mom, yes, she supports me and everything, but my dad used to be like, get on one of these shows, like do something with his voice. The person was one of my best friends, Wunmi Oju, who, you know, because, you know, we met through her.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, sure.
So Wunmi was the person who would be like, just, I would send myself singing to different people, and she'd be the one who'd be like, send this to one of these shows, send this to The Voice, send this to AGT, send this to American Idol, send this to someone, you know. And I'll just be like, ugh, I'm not gonna. So it was during my MBA program that Wumi decided to sign me up for AGT without telling me.
Using our own email address, right?
Went
Or
online, pulled up the online application, filled out everything,
actually did everything on your
attached
behalf.
a song like
Oh,
file of
now
me
you
singing.
are sent to her previously.
Everything, everything. She literally, like, the last video I had sent her of me singing, she just attached it to this online application. She even wrote out the part where, like, they say, you know, about me. And she was like, hi, my name is Ketcher Kuchi. I'm 27 years old. I love
Practically did
singing.
everything for
She
you.
did. I literally have like the screenshot of what she put in there to describe before she pressed submit. And I was like, so when she told me, she had already done it. And it was like midnight that she called, and she was like, yeah, you know. No, she woke, she told me she woke up at like randomly in the middle of the night and just did it and then went back to bed because she was like, she's just tired of me sending these things to her. So she told me the next day that she had done this thing, and she said, if they reject you, Kechi, you wouldn't even know. Like, it would literally just come to me because I put my
And
email.
because she put her email, yes, I read it in the book, and I'm like, oh
Like,
my God.
literally, she was like, don't even worry about it. So she did that in September of 2016, and I forgot about it. Like she said, I was like, okay, whatever, it's done. We didn't talk about it ever again. And then one random morning, Saturday morning, 8 a.m. sharp,
You got a call.
November, I got a phone call, and the woman's name was Destiny. And she was like, hi, I'm a scout from America's Got Talent. Saw your audition. And we're calling to, like, you know, see if you'd be interested in being considered for, you know, being like, you know, a participant in. And I remember just thinking, because I was like, I was sleepy. So I was just like, oh, wow, thank you so much. Okay, bye. Thank you. We'll talk later. And I went back to bed. And then, like, a couple hours later, my alarm went off for when I was meant to wake up. And I woke up and I remember just sitting in bed, like, is someone
Did
just
I?
calling?
Someone just called me,
This
right?
happened.
I
I
read
called the
that.
number back. Yeah, literally, I called the number back and I was just like, I'm sorry. Could you just repeat everything you said earlier? Because I was not
Like I
like.
was dreaming.
And she laughed. She found that so funny because she was like, yeah, I could kind of tell you couldn't, like, really, you weren't really aware of what I was saying. So we talked for a little longer than that and then explained stuff to me, said she was going to send me some emails, blah, blah, blah. And then while I was in the middle of telling my mom, my sister, my dad, like, look what just happened, Wumi calls me and he's like, I just got an email from America's Talent and I don't understand. I was like, oh my God. Well, like, they just called me. So she was like, oh my God. So that's pretty much how that journey started. And while I was on the show, throughout my time on that show, Wumi got all my emails from America's Got Talent because,
Interesting.
like, they had my email, they had her email
They had an email as
on
you, right?
file as
End of
me.
story,
So
yeah.
whenever she didn't, she had to send me everything because a lot
Right.
of times when I finally got on the show, they would have like call times for practice, things like that. And like, if she didn't send it to me, I wouldn't know, like, I would miss it. So,
You would
like,
miss it, yeah, because I know.
She had to send everything to me real quick. So yeah, it was really funny. But that was like an interesting way to like kind of have her, the person who made this happen, like, you know, along for the ride essentially from the beginning.
From the beginning to the end, how would you describe in having a friend like Wumi Ejo in a co in your corner, not just for you but for everybody, like someone who sees beyond what you see, or who even sees that hey, you can do this even beyond your own confidence level at that time? Because at that time you were like
I was like,
maybe
there's no way.
yeah, but
Never.
she and your dad, how would you say having someone like Wumi in your corner might go all the way to make people better off?
I mean, I think everyone needs a friend, at least one person in their life like that, that believes in you, even when you don't believe in yourself, and that sees something in you that they struggle to see in themselves. Because, you know, that's something that, you know, even till today, I'm very critical, and I think that's normal for people to be the most self-critical, you know, when it comes to different types of creative talents. I feel like I'm my worst critic, and I because of that kind of thinking, I never would have put myself out there in that place. But she didn't even bother trying to. She'd already tried to, you know, go through me to explain to me why I
And
shouldn't.
you wouldn't
I
bulge.
never have done it. I was just not gonna do it. She sent me the emails over, like, she would send it to me every season, and all of them too, not just America's Got Talent, every single one of them, just for me to apply, and I would just ignore the emails. So she took matters into her own hands because that's how much confidence she had that there was something here for me.
That's huge.
And I think that having someone like that in your life, I know the thing about Wumi specifically is that she's very much that way for a lot of people, not just me. You know, that, I mean, I'm grateful that she's like, you know, my friend and everything, but she's the kind of person that like sees some, like, is able to kind of connect what people are good at to like the people that can help them develop or nurture that. She has, it's just some, that's one of her like things that is special to her, I think, because she does this for different people. She's so, and even if she hasn't known you for as long as she's known me, she can make those connections really quick, and that's a really cool thing to me about her. So I like to think that the people that are in her life or that they have her in their lives have seen that trait and appreciate,
100%,
you
100%,
yeah. But
100%.
personally, having her as like a friend is something that I cherish because she has proven time and time again that she sees beyond, you know, what I like, the limitations I put on my own capabilities. And I think that I would love to be able to reciprocate that for her, you know, in some way, but
Right,
it's
yeah.
hard because when you're that person that does that, it's really hard to
I know
receive
it's a bit
it.
that part, but it's awesome stuff. Like again, even what may have facilitated me meeting you,
That is
like
true.
without my like I had no idea, like you guys were friends. I had
Yeah.
no idea. So she just called me out of the blues and she said, "Hey, I'm with someone wants to meet you or someone would like to meet you." And I'm like,
Yeah.
you know, and all of that stuff. So,
And
but
all
yeah,
that,
really,
yeah.
we met, you know, but
I think she does, yeah.
just to buttress the you know,
Exactly. Like,
having that kind of person in your corner. She's just sweet like that.
you.
So on a final note, or rather, yeah, on a final note, because we actually have a couple of minutes just left. Simon Cowell was a prominent figure during your journey on American Got Talent, AGT. Describe your relationship with him. I know the relationship probably even blossom past America's Got Talent because he also wrote a foreword for this book, More
He
Than White
did.
Stars. So I would like you to describe your relationship with him, and do you think his mentorship influenced your musical growth in any way?
Very much so, because you know, having the approval of from someone like Simon, who doesn't know me from anywhere, has no reason to make me feel good about myself, has no reason to pat me on my back and like, you know, gas me up. Like, he has no reason to make me to boost me further than what is real or what he perceives as real.
That's it as real.
And so and he's a very strong and big personality in music and has been recognized worldwide as someone who has an eye and an ear for talent when it comes to vocals. So having someone like that, like in your corner, is extremely validating. There's just no denying it, because it's especially because he has no reason to make me feel good about myself that his words have a lot of weight, you know? Because I do, friends and family, of course, I love them and I trust them. And I believe that when they tell me something is good, they think it really is. But it's hard sometimes because there's always going to be
Yeah,
some kind
oh
of
no,
bias.
100%, of
Oh,
course.
there will always be some bias, and that's fine too, you know. But once in a while, you want like an objective opinion from someone unrelated, and I feel like I got that from him, you know. It's because of him that I was able to start actually believing that I had a voice that was like, you know, better than average. And it was his reaction to my second audition that made me feel that way. Because prior to that, I had been feeling very much like I didn't belong there. I'd been feeling very much like I was there mainly because of my story, because let's be real, you know, stories have a lot of impact on that show. And I didn't want to be in a place that I did not belong simply because I have an incredible story that, you know, God is using every day. So I really didn't want there to be any kind of issue with like me being in a space that belonged to someone else. Just story. I wanted my talents to speak as loudly as my story was, you know. So when I only shared these views and these concerns with my mom and my sister and my dad. They're the only ones that knew that I felt this way. I didn't go online to say anything about it or whatever. But somehow he just had that. He must have perceived that that was the right thing to say to me in that moment, because when I finished singing that second audition song, his statement was that he believed that I had proven that I belonged on this stage, not just because of my story, but because of my talent.
Because of your talent.
And those words were so impactful to me at a time when I was doubting my talent,
Your
like,
talent.
so. I think, yeah, I remember I just started crying. I was so grateful because he made me feel like I really belong and that I had
Deserve
a,
that
you know,
spot.
yeah, exactly.
That's
You know,
great.
one thing about me, I don't want to be somewhere where I'm not supposed to be. Like, I remember I kept on telling God, like, look, at any point my time here ends, I'm ready to say my goodbyes. Thank you for bringing me, even on the audition, I'm fine. I just don't want to be here longer than I need to be. And don't embarrass me, God, if you know, if I'm meant to. Just get me out of here whenever I'm meant to leave. So the fact that I got to the end of it was a huge honor and so humbling, because I never envisioned getting that far. It
Getting
was a
that
really
far.
good experience.
Nice. All right. Thank you so much, Katie, for your time. In about 2 minutes, 2 minutes. 2025 just started.
Is
We're in January.
it?
Should we expect something huge from you as it concerns music in 2025, or even maybe a
Really
little
hope so.
more?
I hope so. I really hope so. I have been working on a bunch of duets with
Okay.
some artists that are
Okay.
very interesting,
Okay.
and I can't really say anything yet, I guess.
Course, completely understood.
I'm hoping that like I get like into, I really want to get into soundtrack music
Okay.
for TV shows, movies,
Oh.
video games. Video games is the big one for me. So I really
Mm-hmm.
want to get into that space for doing soundtracks for video games. And I think that would be so fun because I love video games just normally. So I hope that I can break into that industry specifically.
Okay. Written for you.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also Christmas music. So Christmas music is a big thing. And
Where?
I have a song that I hope I can release this year in time for Christmas.
We're
So
looking
I know
forward
that
to
gives me the whole year to
that.
prepare.
Yeah.
So God's grace.
We'll be looking forward to that.
Thank
Definitely
you.
looking forward to that.
Thank
Thank
you.
you so much, Kechi Okuchi, for being a guest on the Debo Taiwo Talk Show. And again, just for anyone who will be seeing this interview up until this very end, we also have the audio version. It would be available or will be available on Conversations with Debo on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcast. Kechi, any final words for me before I have you run?
Thank you so much, Debo, for being patient with me. We have been planning to have this for a long time, and different things kept getting in the way, and I was sick for so long, but you were very patient and accommodating, and I appreciate that. And this was a very fun interview, and I pray for success for your podcast.
Thank you.
I think you're a really good interviewer, and I had a good time. So
Thank
thank
you
you.
so much. Thank you so much, Keiichi. Thank you again. And so this is a wrap up finally from the Debo Taiwo Talk Show. And it was so amazing to have you again, Keiichi Okuchi, on the talk show. I really enjoyed my time with you today and definitely learned a lot from you on face value. Thank you.
Thank you
Next time
so
you
much.
come to Ontario, please let's link up.
You know. All
Okay, cheers and bye for now.
right.